Chapter 29. On a weekend in mid-August, in the seventh month of Donald Trump's presidency, hundreds of white supremacists came into violent conflict with protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia, vividly underscoring once again the racial divide in America. Moving across the campus of the University of Virginia in a haunting nighttime torch walk on a steamy August 11th evening, echoing Germany of the 1930s, around 250 white nationalists chanted, "Jews will not replace us," and the Nazi slogan, "Blood and Soil." The next day, following brawls between white nationalists protesting the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee and counter-protesters, one of the white nationalists drove his car into a crowd of protesters, killing a woman and injuring 19 others. Images of snarling, tiki torch-bearing white men in polos and khakis and video of the vehicle brutally scattering pedestrians became a major television and news spectacle. On Saturday, August 12th, Trump was watching Fox News from his golf course in Bedminster. At 1 p.m. on Fox, a Virginia State Police spokeswoman described the melee. In the crowds, on all sides, they were throwing bottles. They were throwing soda cans with cement in them. They were throwing paintballs. They were fighting, breaking out and attacking one another, launching chemicals into the crowd as well as smoke bombs. At 1:19 p.m., Trump tweeted a call for calm. "We all must be united and condemn all that hate stands for. There is no place for this kind of violence in America. Let's come together as one." Later in the afternoon, at a routine veterans bill signing, Trump had a script that was all condemnation that ended in the word violence. Trump said, "We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence." But he departed from his text and added, on many sides, it's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. This has been going on for a long, long time." He then picked up the text. "It has no place in America." Trump touched a nerve with the phrase "many sides," suggesting an equivalence between the neo-Nazis and those who opposed white supremacy. Biting criticism of the president spanned the political spectrum, including many Republican Party leaders. "Very important for the nation to hear at POTUS describe events in #Charlottesville for what they are, a terror attack by #white supremacists, tweeted Senator Marco Rubio. "Mr. President, we must call evil by its name," tweeted Cory Gardner, Republican senator from Colorado. "These were white supremacists, and this was domestic terrorism." "My brother didn't give his life fighting Hitler for Nazi ideas to go unchallenged here at home," tweeted Senator Orrin Hatch, normally a reliable Trump ally. In a statement, Senator John McCain called Charlottesville a confrontation between our better angels and our worst demons. White supremacists and neo-Nazis are, by definition, opposed to American patriotism and the ideals that define us. House Speaker Paul Ryan tweeted, "White supremacy is a scourge. This hate and its terrorism must be confronted and defeated." Mitt Romney tweeted, "Racial prejudice, then hate, then repugnant speech, then a repulsive rally, then murder. Not supremacy, barbarism." Republican Senator Lindsey Graham appeared on Fox News Sunday and said that the president needs to correct the record here. "These groups seem to believe they have a friend in Donald Trump in the White House, and I would urge the president to dissuade these groups that he's their friend." Vice President Pence added, "We have no tolerance for hate and violence from white supremacists, neo-Nazis, or the KKK. These dangerous fringe groups have no place in American public life and in the American debate, and we condemn them in the strongest terms." News coverage zeroed in on Trump's clear reluctance to condemn the white supremacists. Some noted he had squandered an opportunity to snuff out suspicions that he harbored sympathy for the white supremacists. Kelly had set up a senior staff meeting by secure teleconference for 8 a.m. on Monday, August 14th. He was in Bedminster, but most of the senior staff was at the White House in Washington. Something was wrong with the audio on the secure teleconference equipment, and the start of the call was delayed. "Fuck it," Kelly said after about 30 seconds. "We're not going to do this." He stormed out, causing considerable chatter among the staff about his hot temper and hair trigger. The next day, there was another glitch. "Screw this," Kelly said. "Fuck it. Take the people off the conference line. We're just going to have the meeting with the people who are here." Rob Porter was in Bedminster with Trump and joined a coordinated effort to clean up the mess with a new speech on Charlottesville. A draft had been written by White House speechwriters, and Porter had the draft for Trump to give at the White House the next day, Monday, August 14th. The intent was to show the president as a constructive, calming force. Porter handed the draft to Trump on the flight back to Washington on Air Force One. The two worked through it. The president did not like the tone. He didn't want to sound like he was capitulating to political correctness. Porter and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, now the press secretary, had agreed that they needed to present a united front to get the president to give another speech. "I think it's really important," Sanders told the president, "that you are able to speak directly to the American people, not through the media filter, so that you're not misunderstood on this, and so that people at CNN and MSNBC, whoever it is, aren't able to suggest that you say and mean something different than what you do. You need to be very clear about this, and the best way to do that is for you, without the media filter, to be very precise about it, very direct. And then that way you're able to do that without the media twisting it." Trump defended what he had said. "It's not as if one side has any sort of monopoly on hatred or on bigotry. It's not as if any one group is at fault or anything like that. With the media, you're never going to get a fair shake. Anything that you say or do is going to be criticized." "You need to fix this," Porter argued. "You don't want to be perceived the way in which you're being perceived now. You need to bring the country together." That was the moral obligation. There's no upside to not directly condemn neo-Nazis and those that are motivated by racial animus. There is a huge rift in the country. Porter played heavily to the president's ego and desire to be at the center. He said that the president could be a kind of healer-in-chief, consoler-in-chief. "The country is counting on you rhetorically to help salve the wounds and point a direction forward," Porter said. The president could inspire and uplift. He could make this about him, the Redeemer. Trump did not push back, but he didn't say yes. Back at the White House, the West Wing was undergoing renovation. Trump and Porter went up to the residence. Porter pulled up the speech draft on his laptop. No printer was readily available, so the president and Porter worked from the laptop. Trump, who doesn't touch type or use a keyboard, sat behind his desk. Porter, next to him, scrolled through the draft and they cut and pasted. Trump said at one point, "I don't know about this." The draft was an attack on racism and referred to the necessity of love and healing. "I don't know if this feels right," the president said. It looked weak. He didn't want to apologize. "This doesn't feel right to me." Porter could see before him the two Donald Trumps, two impulses. He was clearly torn. He would not bend to political correctness, yet he did need to bring people together. He soon saw this and did not object to the language. "All right, okay," he said, as Porter scrolled through the draft, making changes that Trump approved. "All right," he finally said. "We'll do this." Porter could see the struggle. Not one to mask his emotions or conclusions, it was clear that Trump wasn't thrilled. Yet he wasn't upset. He wasn't angry. Porter had the final approved version of about 12 paragraphs loaded into the teleprompter. Trump was going to give it from the diplomatic reception room. Shortly after 12:30 p.m., Trump walked to the podium set between the American flag and the presidential flag. He grabbed the podium fiercely with both hands. He frowned. He looked grim and said he was here in Washington to meet with his economic team about trade policy and tax reform. He touted the strong economy, high stock market, and low unemployment rate, and said he was going to provide an update on Charlottesville. The Department of Justice had opened a civil rights investigation, he told the national television audience. To anyone who acted criminally in this weekend's racist violence, Trump said, you will be held fully accountable. Looking stiff and uncomfortable, like someone coerced to speak in a hostage video, the president went on. No matter the color of our skin, we all live under the same laws, we all salute the same great flag. We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, he said, singling out the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups. We will defend and protect the sacred rights of all Americans, so every citizen is free to follow their dreams in their hearts and to express the love and joy in their souls. It was a 5-minute speech that could have been given by President Reagan or Obama. Make sure you tell him how great it was, General Kelly told the senior staff. He had been chief of staff less than 3 weeks. Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn were there to greet Trump at the elevator back to the residence. They showered praise on him. That was a great speech, Cohn said. This was one of your finest moments as president. It was in the grand tradition of unifying and taking the high road of racial healing. Later they told Porter they didn't know how he had managed to convince Trump. Porter felt it was a moment of victory, of actually doing some good for the country. He had served the president well. This made the endless hours of nonstop work worth it. Trump left to watch some Fox. Rob O'Neill, a former Navy SEAL Team 6 leader and author, generally praised Trump for being specific, but added, "That's almost an admission of, okay, I was wrong, and I'm sort of negotiating on this." Fox correspondent Kevin Cork said, some 48 hours into the biggest domestic challenge of his young presidency, Mr. Trump has made a course correction. The suggestion that he had admitted doing wrong and was unsteady infuriated the president. That was the biggest fucking mistake I've made, the president told Porter. You never make those concessions. You never apologize. I didn't do anything wrong in the first place. Why look weak? Though Porter had not written the original draft, he had spent almost 4 hours editing it with Trump, providing the accommodating language. But strangely, Trump did not direct his rage at Porter. I can't believe I got forced to do that, Trump said, apparently still not blaming Porter, but venting directly to him. That's the worst speech I've ever given. I'm never going to do anything like that again. He continued to stew about what he had said and how it was a huge mistake. Chapter 30. The next day, Tuesday, Trump had meetings in New York to discuss his infrastructure proposal for spending on roads, bridges, and schools. In the afternoon, he was scheduled to give a press briefing in the lobby of Trump Tower. A blue curtain had been draped over the Ivanka Trump brand display in the lobby. Before going down, he asked for printouts of the really good lines from the two Charlottesville statements he had made. He said he wanted the precise language he had used in case he was asked. Don't take any questions, all the staff told him with urgency. Trump said he did not plan on taking any. At the press briefing, he took questions, and the questions were about Charlottesville. He took out his Saturday statement. As I said on Remember Saturday, we condemn, in the strongest possible terms, the egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. He left out the part about both sides, but this time he added, the alt-left came charging at the rally. You had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. Not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch. Many of those people were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. I wonder, is it George Washington next week, and is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? Both had been slave owners, he noted. You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop? He reverted to his earlier argument. There is blame on both sides. You also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had a lot of bad people in the other group, too. There are two sides to a story. David Duke, the well-known former Ku Klux Klan leader, tweeted, "Thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage to tell the truth about hashtag Charlottesville." The leaders of each branch of the U.S. military went on a social media offensive against their commander-in-chief in a stunning rebuke. Chief of Naval Operations Admiral John Richardson tweeted, "Events in Charlottesville unacceptable and mustn't be tolerated. At U.S. Navy forever stands against intolerance and hatred." Marine Corps Commandant General Robert B. Neller wrote that there is no place for racial hatred or extremism in at USMC. Our core values of honor, courage, and commitment frame the way Marines live and act. And Chief of Staff of the Army Mark Milley tweeted, "The Army doesn't tolerate racism, extremism, or hatred in our ranks. It's against our values and everything we've stood for since 1775. The Air Force and National Guard chiefs followed with similar statements. On CBS, Stephen Colbert joked darkly, "It's just like D-Day. Remember D-Day? Two sides, allies and the Nazis? There was a lot of violence on both sides, ruined a beautiful beach, and it could have been a golf course." Former General John Kelly had stood in the Trump Tower lobby as Trump took questions with a grim look on his face. Colbert said, "This guy is a four-star general. Iraq, no problem. Afghanistan, we can do it. 20-minute Trump press conference? A quagmire." Porter had watched from the sidelines in the Trump Tower lobby. He was in a state of shock, shattered, and in disbelief. Later, when Trump brought up the second speech to him, the staff secretary said, "I thought the second speech was the only good one of the three." "I don't want to talk to you," Trump responded. "Get away from me." Kelly later told the president that because he had made three statements, now everybody has one to choose and it might work in the president's favor. Maybe it's the best of all possible worlds. He said his wife liked Tuesday's statement and press conference, the third one, because it showed the president being strong and defiant. Kenneth Frazier, the head of Merck, the giant pharmaceutical company, and one of the few African-American CEOs of a Fortune 500 company, announced he was resigning from Trump's American Manufacturing Council, a group of outside business advisors to the president. "America's leaders must honor our fundamental values by clearly rejecting expressions of hatred, bigotry, and group supremacy. As CEO of Merck and as a matter of personal conscience, I feel a responsibility to take a stand against intolerance and extremism," Frazier said in a statement. Within an hour, Trump attacked Frazier on Twitter. "Now that Frazier had resigned," Trump wrote, "he will have more time to lower rip-off drug prices." The CEOs of Under Armour and Intel followed Frazier, resigning from the council as well. Still stewing, in a second Twitter swipe at Frazier, Trump wrote that Merck should bring jobs back and lower prices. On Tuesday, August 15th, Trump tweeted, "For every CEO that drops out of the Manufacturing Council, I have many to take their place." He called those who had resigned grandstanders. Trump's press conference proved too much for the members of the President's Strategic and Policy Forum, a second advisory board, and the Manufacturing Council. Throughout the day, the CEOs of 3M, Campbell Soup, and General Electric announced their resignations from the Manufacturing Council as did representatives from the AFL-CIO and the Alliance for American Manufacturing President. Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, told employees that the Strategic and Policy Forum had decided to disband. Trump preempted further resignations by abolishing both groups via Twitter. Rather than putting pressure on the business people of the Manufacturing Council and Strategy and Policy Forum, I am ending both. Thank you all. Most significant, however, were the private reactions from House Speaker Ryan and Senate Majority Leader McConnell. Both Republicans called some of the CEOs and privately praised them for standing up. On Friday, August 18th, Gary Cohn flew by helicopter from East Hampton, Long Island to Morristown, New Jersey, where it was raining heavily. He had to wait on the tarmac to get clearance to Bedminster. He was carrying a resignation letter. This was too much. Someone had put a swastika on his daughter's college dorm room. He headed to the clubhouse where Trump was going to address a member-guest tournament. Walking into applause, Trump shook hands and made remarks, reminding everyone he had won the member-guest before. Trump and Cohn took food from the buffet and slipped into a private dining room. "Mr. President," Cohn said when they were alone, "I'm very uncomfortable with the position you have put me and my family in. I don't want this to be a contentious discussion." "You don't know what you are talking about," Trump said. They debated what Trump had said and what he had not said. "Before you say anything further," the president said, "I want you to go back and listen to it again." "Sir," Cohn replied, "I've listened to it like 30 times. Have you seen the video, sir?" Cohn said. "No, I haven't seen the video." "I want you to watch the video, sir," Cohn said. "I need you to watch the video of a bunch of white guys carrying tiki torches saying, 'Jews will not replace us.' I cannot live in a world like that." "You go listen and you go read," Trump said. "I'll go watch the video." They agreed to discuss it after they had done their listening and watching. "I said nothing wrong," Trump said. "I meant what I said." "The Monday statement was great," Cohn said. "Saturday and Tuesday were horrible." The next Monday at the White House, Cohn appeared at the Oval Office. Ivanka was sitting on one of the couches. Kelly was standing behind a chair. Cohn was halfway into the Oval Office when Trump said, "So you're here to resign?" "Yes, sir, I am." "I've done nothing wrong," Trump repeated. He was leaving because of your liberal Park Avenue friends. This must be your wife, Trump said, blaming Cohn's wife. Trump launched into a story about a great golfer. The golfer's wife complained because he was gone every weekend. So he listened to her, and now, Trump said, the once great golfer is selling golf balls and making no money, completing his blame the wife narrative. "Everyone wants your position," Trump continued. "I made a huge mistake giving it to you." The president continued with venom. It was chilling. Cohn had never been talked to or treated like that in his life. "This is treason," Trump said. Trump turned to trying to make Cohn feel guilty. "You are driving our policy, and if you leave now, taxes are over. You can't do this." Cohn had spent months working a tax cut plan and was in the middle of negotiations on the Hill, a massive, complex undertaking. "How could you leave me hanging like that?" "Sir, I don't ever want to leave you hanging. I don't want anyone to ever think I betrayed them. I have a reputation I care more about than anything in the world. I'm working for free here in the White House. It's not about money, it's about helping the country. If you think I'm betraying you, I will never do that." And relenting, he added, "I will stay and get taxes done, but I can't stay here and say nothing." Vice President Pence walked in and stood next to Cohn and touched him affectionately. They needed to keep Cohn, Pence said, but he understood the position Cohn was in. Yes, Cohn should say something publicly. "Go out there and say whatever you want," Trump said. "Mnuchin said something." Mnuchin had put out a statement. "I strongly condemn the actions of those filled with hate. They have no defense from me, nor do they have any defense from the president or this administration." He quoted and commended Trump's initial response to Charlottesville and added, "As someone who is Jewish, while I find it hard to believe I should have to defend myself on this or the president, I feel compelled to let you know that the president in no way, shape, or form believes that neo-Nazi and other hate groups who endorse violence are equivalent to groups that demonstrate in peaceful and lawful ways." Trump cited others who had distanced themselves from him. "I don't have a platform," Cohn replied. "What do you mean?" asked Trump. "The cabinet secretaries had press departments," Cohn said. "They can go out and make statements whenever they want. I'm an assistant to the president. I'm not supposed to be making press statements." "I don't care," Trump said. "Go to the podium right now and make a statement." He was inviting Cohn to go to the podium in the press room of the White House. "I'm not going to do that, sir. That's embarrassing. That's not what you do. Let me do it my way." "I don't care what way you do it," Trump said. "I just don't want you leaving until taxes are done, and you can say whatever you need to say." "Do you want to see it before I say it?" Trump seemed to be of two minds. "Nope," Trump replied at first. "Say whatever you want to say." But then he asked what it might be. "Could we see it first?" Cohn said he would work with the White House Communications Department. On the way out of the Oval Office, General Kelly, who had heard it all, pulled Cohn into the cabinet room. According to notes that Cohn made afterward, Kelly said, "That was the greatest show of self-control I have ever seen. If that was me, I would have taken that resignation letter and shoved it up his ass 6 different times." A few minutes later, Pence showed up in Cohn's West Wing office. He reiterated his support. "Say whatever you need and want to say, and continue to serve your country," he said, thanking him for everything. Cohn chose to make his views known in an interview with the Financial Times. "This administration can and must do better. I have come under enormous pressure both to resign and to remain. I also feel compelled to voice my distress. Citizens standing up for equality and freedom can never be equated with white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and the KKK." Cohn could tell that Trump was angry because the president would not talk to him for a couple of weeks. At regular meetings, Trump would ignore him. Finally, one day, Trump turned to him and asked, "Gary, what do you think?" The inner administration shunning was over, but the scar remained. To Rob Porter, Charlottesville was the breaking point. Trump rejected the better judgment of almost all of his staff. He had done that before. His perverse independence and irrationality ebbed and flowed. But with Charlottesville, the floodgates just opened. For just the sake of a few words, he had drawn a stark line. "This was no longer a presidency," Porter said. "This is no longer a White House. This is a man being who he is." Trump was going ahead no matter what. As Porter saw it from up close, perhaps as close as anyone on the staff except Hope Hicks, the Trump election had rekindled the divide in the country. There was a more hostile relationship with the media. The culture wars were reinvigorated. There was a racist tinge. Trump accelerated it. Porter wondered if trying to repair any of those divisions after Charlottesville was almost a lost cause. There was no turning back. Trump had crossed the point of no return. To the Trump opponents and haters, he was un-American, racist. There was so much fuel on that fire already, and Trump had added so much more. The fire was going to burn, and it was going to burn brightly. It was now an almost permanent state of suspicion, disbelief, and hostility. "It's just all-out war now." Chapter 31. In the midst of the Charlottesville controversy, Bannon called Kelly. "I know this guy," he said. "If you don't start having people in the White House covering for Trump, there would be trouble. You've got to cover for him." Republican Senator Bob Corker had told reporters, "The president has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence needed to succeed in office." And Politico had run a long piece on Trump's anger issues, calling Trump driven by his temper and saying, "Anger serves as a way to manage staff, express his displeasure, or simply as an outlet that soothes him." "Not one guy in the White House at the senior level has come out and defended him," Bannon said. Bannon felt that Trump should be winning the messaging war. President Trump, by asking, "Where does this all end? Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln," connects with the American people. The race identity politics of the left wants to say it's all racist. "Just give me more. I can't get enough of it." Vice President Mike Pence had dutifully retweeted some of Trump's more benign remarks and added, as @POTUS Trump said, "We have to come together as Americans with love for our nation and true affection for each other. #Charlottesville. Bannon told Kelly, "If he gets boxed in, you're going to have free shots on goal from the guys on Capitol Hill. You have to start protecting this guy." "Do you fucking want to take this job?" Kelly asked. "Excuse me? Do you want to be fucking chief of staff?" "What are you talking about?" Bannon replied. "Don't pull that on me. You know you're the only guy to do it." "Listen," Kelly said. "My problem right now is I think I'm going to lose half the guys here, and I could lose a third of the cabinet. You don't understand. This thing's on a knife's edge. People are not going to just tolerate this. This has got to be condemned. If you think you've got a solution." Bannon did not. But he did tell Kelly he was going to resign. "Look, I'm going to leave on Friday," Bannon said. Tomorrow would be his last day. "I think that may be best," said Kelly. But Bannon was worried about Trump's upcoming weekend at Camp David that would include the final NSC meeting before the Afghanistan decision. "Just make sure the president gets every option and detail." "I'll make sure that happens," Kelly said. That was his standard line. The president would get the full story and the full range of options. "Make sure Pompeo gets a full chance to make his pitch." Kelly said he would. Bannon knew Trump was heading toward a globalist decision. The forces of the national security establishment, led by McMaster, were setting him up. They were creating a record that Trump had been briefed fully about the potential Afghanistan threat as a base for future 9/11-style terrorism. If the threat materialized, they would leak to the Washington Post or the New York Times that Trump had ignored the warning. Under the plan for the NSC meeting on August 18th, Sessions and Kellogg would advocate pulling out of Afghanistan. CIA Director Pompeo would argue for expanding the CIA paramilitary role instead of additional troops, a position he and Bannon had crafted. McMaster would argue for staying the course, which meant adding 4,000 troops. Sessions began by noting that he had been on the Senate Armed Services Committee since 9/11. "I've always heard the same thing. We're 6 months to 18 months from turning Afghanistan around. Time and time again, the same. You guys have always been wrong. Look at the major decisions to add tens of thousands of troops by Obama," he hammered. "A major turnaround promised and expected. Always wrong. That's why we've been here for 16 years. The Taliban now control more than half the country. Withdraw now. Give it up." Kellogg concurred. "Gotta come home." Pompeo had gone through some come-to-Jesus sessions at Langley. The old hands reminded him that Afghanistan was the graveyard not just of empires, but of careers. the agency had spent years in a subsidiary role with the CTPT paramilitary teams, avoiding full responsibility. Afghanistan was the Army's problem, the agency old hands advised. Keep it that way. Another consideration? Under Pompeo's proposed plan, the Army would be in charge of the CTPT and would never give the CIA real control. There was no guarantee or reasonable expectation of success, and somebody's going to get blamed down the road. When it came time for Pompeo to make the case for the middle course, he reigned all over his own alternative. It would take us about 2 years for the CIA to get ready to expand its CTPT counterterrorist effort, he said. We're not physically ready and don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the ability to step in and co-run such an ambitious undertaking with special forces. The CIA assets in Afghanistan have atrophied. It's not a viable alternative today. McMaster was then up to make the case for staying the course and adding up to 4,000 troops. His key argument was that a major strategic objective was to prevent al-Qaeda or other terrorists from hitting the U.S. homeland or other allies. I'm tired of hearing that, Trump said, because you guys could say that about every country in the world. You keep talking about there's ISIS all over. They could be organizing an attack on us. We can't be everywhere. Trump exploded, most particularly at his generals. You guys have created this situation. It's been a disaster. You are the architects of this mess in Afghanistan. You created these problems. You're smart guys, but I have to tell you, you're part of the problem. And you haven't been able to fix it. And you're making it worse. And now, he added, echoing Sessions, you're wanting to add even more troops to something I don't believe in. I was against this from the beginning. He folded his arms. I want to get out, the president said, and you're telling me the answer is to get deeper in. Mattis, with his quiet style, had immense impact on the decision. He was not a confronter. As he often did, he adopted the approach that less was more. I think what you're saying is right, he told Trump, and your instincts are right on the money. But a new approach could work. Ending artificial Obama-style timelines and lifting restrictions on the on-the-ground commanders. Leaving could precipitate the collapse of the Afghan state. U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan had left the vacuum for al-Qaeda to create a terrorist sanctuary leading to the 9/11 attacks. The problem is that a new terrorist attack, especially a large one originating from Afghanistan, would be a catastrophe. He argued that if they pulled out, they would create another ISIS-style upheaval. ISIS already had a presence in Afghanistan. What happened in Iraq under Obama with the emergence of ISIS will happen under you, Mattis told Trump, in one of his sharpest declarations. It was a barb that several present remembered. You all are telling me that I have to do this, Trump said grudgingly, and I guess that's fine and we'll do it, but I still think you're wrong. I don't know what this is for. It hasn't gotten us anything. We've spent trillions, he exaggerated. We've lost all these lives. Yet, he acknowledged, they probably could not cut and run and leave a vacuum for al-Qaeda, Iran, and other terrorists. After the meeting, Sessions called Bannon. He spit the bit, Sessions said, using a term for an exhausted, worn-down racehorse's rejection of its rider's control. Who? Bannon asked. Your boy Pompeo. What are you talking about? That was the worst presentation I ever saw, Sessions said. He and Kellogg had done their best. I couldn't have been any better. Kellogg was fantastic. McMaster was actually better than he's ever been because you weren't around. The president actually said afterwards that I and Kellogg made the best presentation. But clearly, the president was looking for the middle option as an alternative. How bad was Pompeo? His heart wasn't in it. How could it not be? Bannon called Pompeo. What the fuck happened? We set this whole thing up for you to come and own it. I can take that building only so far, Pompeo said of the CIA. I've got other fights I've got to win. Pompeo reported what the senior officials at Langley were telling him. What are you doing? Pompeo was getting excellent reviews, and Trump liked his style. You're on a roll, but you're going to be held accountable for this. One person at Langley had told him, We spent 10 years in Washington making sure we weren't held accountable for anything in Afghanistan. Why are you volunteering? We never volunteer for anything. Don't worry about Bannon. He is a clown. He's crazy. This is the Pentagon trying to trap us because they want out, too. Pompeo described the CIA's position. We don't have the apparatus to take command of this. This is something the Army's got to do. You're saying make it a joint venture. We don't have those kinds of resources. We don't have that kind of expertise on the scale they're talking about. We're not going to take responsibility. Are you going to take responsibility for Afghanistan? Because we're not going to win. You understand? We're not going to win. And that would be hard because Trump was saying, How come we're not winning? How come they're, the Taliban, blowing up guys? Bannon talked to Trump by phone. You know where I stand on this, Bannon said. I think eventually you're going to come to see the middle ground. You didn't hear the whole thing, Trump said. There's really a new strategy in there, and we're going to win. At the August 18th NSC meeting, Trump approved McMaster's 4 R's. Summarized in a 60-page strategy memo dated August 21st, signed by McMaster, they were formalized as reinforce, provide more equipment and training, but leverage support with conditions to drive reforms. Realign. U.S. civilian assistance and political outreach will be realigned to target key areas under government control, with contested areas considered on case-by-case basis. Reconcile. Diplomatic efforts will urge government to undertake broader efforts to foster inclusivity and political accommodation, promote elections, and conduct outreach of ethnic and regional power brokers. And regionalize. Work with regional actors. The memo said the meeting established that the goal in Afghanistan was to reshape the security environment, to limit the Taliban's military options, and encourage them to negotiate a political settlement that reduces violence and denies safe haven to terrorists. Trump authorized Mattis to designate the Taliban and the terrorist Haqqani Network in Pakistan as hostile forces. Buried in the 19-page section on integrated strategy was an admission. Stalemate likely to persist in Afghanistan, and Taliban likely to continue to gain ground. In the tradition of concealing the real story in a memo, win is unattainable, was the conclusion signed by McMaster. You're the first person I called, Trump told Graham. I just met with the generals. I'm going to go with the generals. Well, Mr. President, that's probably the smartest thing any president could have done. That was a hard one, Trump said. It's the graveyard of empires. It was a reference to a book by Seth G. Jones on Afghanistan. It's my luck the only book you ever read was that one, Graham joked. Trump laughed along. Off the record, Trump said to his senior staff on Air Force One, though there was no press present on Friday, August 18th, I just fired Bannon. Did you see what he said about North Korea and having no military option? Motherfucker! Bannon had just given an interview to Robert Kuttner of the liberal American Prospect, suggesting that Trump's belligerent language to North Korea threatening fire and fury was a bluff. There's no military solution here, Bannon said. They got us. He added, until somebody solves the part of the equation that shows me that 10 million people in Seoul don't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons, I don't know what you're talking about. Trump was worried about a prolonged war of words with Bannon and upset that he wasn't going quietly. A nationally televised Afghanistan strategy speech was set for Monday night, August 21st, in front of a military audience at Fort Myer in Virginia. This was a big deal, one of Trump's first formal announcements of a policy before a large audience. My original instinct was to pull out, and historically, I like following my instincts, Trump said. Three times he said the goal was to win, and said, "We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military." With that, Trump dodged Bush's and Obama's Achilles heel. His strategy had the effect of pushing the Afghanistan war debate away, off the front page and out of the news, unless there was a major act of violence. John McCain commented, "I commend President Trump for taking a big step in the right direction with the new strategy for Afghanistan." Democratic Senator and Clinton running mate Tim Kaine said the U.S. needed to make sure that Afghanistan is not a breeding ground for things that can come back and hurt us. Bannon spoke with Stephen Miller. "What the fuck was that speech about?" Bannon said. "First of all, it just went around in circles." The speech did not really go in circles. It was both new and more of the same Obama strategy. Bannon's chief objection was the lack of realism. "You can't have him sitting there talking about victory. There's not going to be a victory." Trump clung to the rhetoric of winning. He had given the military, Mattis and McMaster, just enough. The military had saved face and did not have to admit defeat. The day after the president's speech, Tillerson found another way to declare that a win was not attainable. He addressed the Taliban at a press briefing. "You will not win a battlefield victory. We may not win one, but neither will you." Stalemate. Chapter 32. Kelly and Porter spent several weeks at Bedminster with the president during the August congressional recess. The new chief of staff was of the view that the White House was a muddle. Priebus and Bannon had been amateurs. He would instill some order and discipline. "We sort of tried to do this a little bit," Porter said. He told Kelly how Priebus had taken a run at establishing order. Several months earlier, Priebus had the top staffers, McMaster, Cohn, Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, and Porter, for a meeting in a strategy room in the executive office building. "We need a strategy," Priebus had said. "What are the priorities? How are we going to sequence them?" He wrote the ideas on whiteboards that lined the walls of the strategy room. It was like a skiff for the most highly classified discussions. It was filled with computers and video teleconferencing equipment. Ideas from the session were never taken seriously. The president often made decisions with only one or two or three people involved. There was no process for making and coordinating decisions. Chaos and disorder were inadequate to describe the situation. It was a free-for-all. The president would have an idea and say, "I want to sign something." And Porter would have to explain that while Trump had broad authority to issue executive orders, for example, a president was frequently restricted by law. Trump had no understanding of how government functioned. At times, he would just start drafting orders himself or dictating. The basic tactic Porter had employed from the Priebus days until now was to stall and delay, mention the legal roadblocks, and occasionally lift the drafts from the Resolute desk. Porter had been screaming bloody process, as he called it, every day for months. They needed an iron grip on what was signed and ordered. If not iron, they needed at least something, a thread of control. On August 21st, Kelly and Porter issued two memorandums to all cabinet officers and senior White House assistants. "The White House Staff Secretary, Porter, serves as both the inbox and outbox for all presidential materials. Every single piece of paper, including decision memos, every memo, press releases, even news articles, had to go through Porter. Executive orders would take at least 2 weeks to complete, including required review by the White House counsel and the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel, which provided legal interpretation to the White House. All paper leaving the Oval Office must be submitted to the staff secretary for compliance with the Presidential Records Act. A second memo, underlined in the original, said, "Decisions are not final and therefore may not be implemented until the staff secretary secures a cleared decision memoranda that has been signed by the president." This included all new policy initiatives such as budget, healthcare, trade initiatives, and government operations such as diplomatic, intelligence, or military operations. A decision made following an oral briefing is not final until there was a formal decision memo. It was a fantasy. Kelly and Porter sat down with the president to explain the revamped process. "You can't make decisions unless you sign a decision memo," Porter said. The memo did not have to be long. "I'll keep it to a page." Porter noted that decision memos would have supporting materials, "but I won't ever make you read more than a page on any decision. I'll come in and I'll brief you on it as well, so we can talk through it. Sometimes you'll need to have a full meeting with 5 or 6 or 7 advisors. A lot of times we can just do it on the basis of a decision memo." "Okay," Trump said. For the first weeks, the new system annoyed the president. Eventually, Porter developed a routine and would bring in 2 to 10 decision memos for him to sign each day. Trump liked signing. It meant he was doing things, and he had an up-and-down penmanship that looked authoritative in black magic marker. Kelly was very chummy with the president in the first weeks, Porter noticed. They were peers. Kelly always seemed to have a smile on his face when he was around the president. He would joke around with Trump. He would give advice and offer his reaction. "Mr. President, I think we ought to do this." He was deferential. "I'm just a staffer. You're the boss. We want to try to get you the best information." The perfect chief of staff. "You're the decider, and I'm not trying to sway you one way or the other." The honeymoon was soon over. Beginning in September, Kelly and Porter would be together alone or with a few senior staffers. "The president's unhinged," Kelly said. "There would be something, especially about trade agreements or the U.S. troops in South Korea." "We all need to try to talk him out of it," Kelly said. They needed to stand up to the president. He wasn't listening. Oval Office business and decision-making became increasingly haphazard. "The president just really doesn't understand anything about that. He doesn't know what he's talking about," Kelly said. As Trump redoubled on withdrawing from trade agreements or costly foreign policies, Kelly would say, "I can't believe he's thinking about doing this." He made a personal appeal to Porter. "Rob, you've got to put a stop to this. Don't write that order up. Don't go down and do that. Can you go in and talk to him and just see if you can make any progress? I was on the phone with him this morning. I made these arguments. Can you go see what good you can do?" The U.S. troop presence in South Korea continued to be a constant theme with Trump. "We are subsidizing South Korea," he insisted. "It doesn't make any sense." Porter reminded him that Mattis and many others had told him these were possibly the best national security dollars that the United States spent. The troop presence provided the indispensable top-secret intelligence that was vital to detecting and deterring North Korean missile launches. On August 25th, the president decided he was going to make a sweeping decision on NAFTA, CORUS, and the World Trade Organization. "We've talked about this ad nauseum," Trump said. "Just do it. Just do it. Get out of NAFTA, get out of CORUS, and get out of the WTO. We're withdrawing from all three." Cohn and Porter enlisted Kelly, who didn't want trade to roil national security. Kelly and Porter went to the Oval Office. "South Korea is an ally," Kelly told Trump. "The CORUS deal is actually better than you think." Porter presented some studies showing that CORUS kept the trade deficit down. "This is a really important time with North Korea and that whole region," Kelly said. We don't want to do anything on the trade side, especially given how peanuts this is in the grand scheme of things. It's going to blow things up. He recommended that the president call Tillerson. Tillerson made the same arguments. Tillerson, Mattis, McMaster, Kelly, everyone on the national security side agreed that if the trade deficit with South Korea had been 10 times greater, it still wouldn't justify withdrawing. It was insane to even be thinking of that, they agreed. All right, Trump finally said on Friday, September 1st. We're not going to do the chorus 180-day thing today. It's not that we're not going to do it, but all right, we won't do it today. Porter put out the word to the legislative staff, the White House lawyers, and the NSC staff to rest easy for at least that day. He made sure there was nothing drafted that the president could sign. 4 days later, on September 5th, Cohn, Porter, and the others went to the Oval Office. Trump had in his hands a draft letter giving notice of the required 180 days that the United States was withdrawing from CORUS. Porter had not written it, and he was never sure who had, probably Navarro or Ross, but he never found out for sure. I've got a draft, Trump said. We're going to withdraw from this. I just need to wordsmith this, and we're going to get it on official stationery and send this off. We need to do it today. McMaster made the national security arguments. Cohn and Porter made the trade and economic arguments. Until I actually take some action to demonstrate my threats are real and need to be taken seriously, Trump said, then we're going to have less leverage in these things. He then left the Oval Office. Now that the president had gone outside of the staff secretary process that Porter controlled to get a new draft letter, Cohn was really worried. He removed it from the president's desk. For the first several months of his job as chief of staff, it seemed that Kelly sat in the Oval Office almost every day in every meeting. He didn't say much, acting more as an observer and monitor. He tried to make sure that the door was closed between the Oval Office and the little outer office where Madeleine Westerhout sat. She was 27, a former RNC aide, and looked like Hope Hicks with her long brown hair and big smile. The stated reason was to provide more privacy and security. Kelly also wanted to keep people from wandering in and out as they had done regularly in the past. No, no, leave it open, the president would say. I need to be able to see Madeleine so that I can call out to her. Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, the president's White House physician, stopped by to see the president most days, certainly several times a week. How are you doing today, Mr. President? He would say, sticking his head out of his office as the president passed by. It would usually be a 30-second check-in, often about something like a nasal spray. Several times, Dr. Jackson visited Kelly. The president's been under a lot of stress recently, Jackson said at one point. We may need to figure out some way to dial things back or to ease up on his schedule. Another time, Jackson was more specific. Seems like the president's under more stress than usual. We may just want to try to cut back on the schedule tomorrow. Kelly's solution was to give the president more executive time. Trump normally set his own schedule on when to start the day and often had flexibility when he returned to the residence. Kelly tried to respond to Jackson. Which meetings were essential? Could they give Trump an extra half hour or an hour in the mornings or clear his schedule an hour earlier in the evenings? They tried. But the nonstop presidency did not abate, and Trump often got everyone, himself included, spun up. Trump assembled a group in the residence to discuss steel tariffs. Ross, Navarro, Lighthizer, Cohn, McMaster, and Porter attended. Trump said he was tired of the debate and wanted to sign a decision memo to implement 25% steel tariffs across the board with no exemptions for any country. They had the usual Groundhog Day round of arguments until Mnuchin said that tax reform had to be the number one priority. A Republican-held House, Senate, and White House was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to pass tax reform, he said. It had not been done since Reagan's presidency more than 30 years earlier. Mnuchin warned that many of the Republican senators he would need for tax reform were free traders and strongly opposed steel tariffs. "Mr. President, you could lose them," he said. Cohn seconded this, and Porter agreed. McMaster, who had been arguing on national security grounds that steel tariffs would severely damage relations with key allies, agreed about taxes and Republican senators. "Yeah, you're right," Trump finally said. "As important as this is, we can't jeopardize the tax bill for this. So, we'll hold off. But as soon as we're done with taxes, we're going to move to trade. And one of the first things that we need to do is put these steel tariffs on." With Bannon out of the White House, Trump and Sessions came up with another solution for immigration on September 5th. Trump announced the end of the Obama-era DACA program. He labeled it an amnesty-first approach and said Congress should find a replacement in 6 months. 2 days later, he tried to calm everyone down. On September 7th, Trump tweeted, "For all those, DACA, that are concerned about your status during the six-month period, you have nothing to worry about. No action." Bannon, who still had access to Trump, called to remind him of the importance of hardline anti-immigration. "Do you understand this almost destroyed the Republican Party in the summer of 2013? Bannon recalled asking the president. "This is the central reason you're president. The one thing that can destroy the Republican Party. It's been haunting us, this amnesty issue." Stephen Miller passed word from the White House to Bannon that this whole debate was now about chain migration. He calculated that the current policy would add 50 million new immigrants in 20 years if it continued. Miller told Bannon, "The Democrats will never give up on chain migration. It's changed the country. Chain migration is everything. That's how they get the family unification." Miller turned out to be correct. Trump might continue to talk as if he would compromise, but there was no deal with Democrats. "I don't have any good lawyers," Trump said one day in the Oval Office. "I have terrible lawyers." He singled out White House counsel Don McGahn. "I've got a bunch of lawyers who are not aggressive, who are weak, who don't have my best interests in mind, who aren't loyal. It's just a disaster. I can't find a good lawyer." He included the personal lawyers he had handling the Mueller investigation. Porter went to Kelly's office to give him a heads up. It was just the two of them. "I've seen this before," Porter said. "I'm concerned because there have been some times in the past, including especially after the appointment of the special counsel, the Comey-Mueller period, where the president got so consumed and distracted that it was a challenge to continue to do the work and make the decisions, effectively to be president, and to give the direction that the rest of us needed to be able to carry on the work of the government. Thankfully, we got through it. I'm concerned that there are going to be those kinds of flare-ups again, especially as the investigation takes its course, as things come to a head. I don't know what the catalyst is going to be." "It could even be something from the Senate and House Russia investigations. Or who knows what. But we need to be cognizant of this. If we don't do a better job of partitioning things, of giving him time and space to deal with some of the Mueller stuff where the president could get his head in a better place, then it is going to infect the rest of the White House." Trump needed time to vent and sort of emotionally stabilize himself. Porter urged Kelly to give this some thought, "so that you can be prepared, so that we can continue to function and this doesn't lead to an incapacitation of the entire West Wing for days, if not weeks, like it kind of did in the past." Kelly nodded. "Yeah, I've seen little bits and pieces of that, and I can imagine it being that bad." "We barely got by the last time it happened," Porter said. "It could be even worse than before. So we need to start to game out a plan for how to handle that." Kelly agreed that made sense. "Let's try," he said. But neither had an immediate idea.